And I'm thankful for you all, and I'm thankful to be with you all this morning to cover some messages. And in the providence of God, many things have come together for this message in this season. In our current series, we are studying about systematic theology from the Old Testament, and we've gone through a lot of different doctrines to make sure we know what we believe and why we believe what we believe. We've been going through the Godhead, and we've been talking about sin and salvation and Bible and man and a lot of different topics, even eschatology we've covered in part. But today's topic is ecclesiology. That's the word that we're studying today, the category of systematic theology is ecclesiology. And you say, what in the world does that mean? It is the doctrine of the church. It is the doctrine of the church. Now, some of you, when we say that, and we're going to study this from the Old Testament, you say, well, hold on a second. I thought that the church was a mystery. I thought that the church is not in the Old Testament. Rather, we have Israel in the Old Testament, and the church is in the New Testament. And you would be absolutely correct. There are lots of reasons why the church is explicitly not in the Old Testament. For one, like I said, Paul calls the church a mystery, an entity that has not been revealed in the Old Testament but was revealed in the New Testament. Well, if it's not revealed or discussed at all in the Old Testament, it's a complete surprise, it's a complete mystery, then that means it only exists in the New Testament period. That would be true. Second, we can understand that the word Israel is not the same idea as the word church. Israel really does mean the ethnic people of Israel. That's used consistently both in the Old Testament as well as in the New Testament. So that goes through and through, and there is therefore even a linguistic distinction between Israel and the church. Third, Paul, he even talks about Israel having a distinctive future as a unique entity in the plan of God. See Romans 9 through 11. And Jesus, remember what he says in Matthew 16? I will build my church. Notice the future tense there. He didn't say, I was already building my church. He says, I will build it, which means it comes later. It is something like a mystery, a new revelation. And finally, here's something that people say, because they get really into these kinds of things, and they come up with some kind of brilliant notion. They say, well, wait a minute. The word, the Greek word, ekklesia, which means church, where we get the word ecclesiology from, that's actually found in the Greek Old Testament translation. And so maybe the church really is in the Old Testament. It just that we didn't translate it as church. We just translated it as gathering, because that's fundamentally what a church is. Well, it's true. That word is found in the Old Testament, and it's found in the New Testament. And in a lot of cases, it's not talking about the church. Even in the New Testament, you can have that word talking about the gathering of Israel. Or in later on in Acts, you have the gathering of the people in Ephesus. Those are not gatherings of the church. But the New Testament understands that there is a technical use, a special use, a specific use of church when it applies to the institution, when it applies to what we know as the church. And so when it uses the word gathering in a more generic fashion, it has to modify it. It has to say the gathering of Israel, or the gathering of the people in Ephesus, or the gathering of these individuals. It uses that often and often just so that you don't confuse those gatherings with the gathering of God's people. And so through and through, no matter how you look at it, the church is not Israel. The church is its own distinctive entity, and the church is not found in the Old Testament. And you say, well, great, we're done. Ecclesiology, you can't find it in the Old Testament. Ciao, finally you finished on time, even early. Congratulations. You wish. But in all seriousness, there are a lot of principles that happen in the Old Testament that set up for the church, that connect with the church. Even though It may very well be that the church isn't mentioned in the Old Testament. There are a lot of truths that are going to pertain to and that ground how we understand the nature of church. And one of those principles, and it is so crucial, is this principle, the principle of corporate witness. The principle of corporate witness. We often think about our witness relative to us as individuals, our personal evangelism, our personal discipleship, our personal declaration of the gospel. And yes, that's true. That's why there are classes and ministries and even our own pressure on ourselves to be salt and light wherever we are. Individual witness is true. But there is another dynamic. It is often a forgotten dynamic, which is why you need to go back to the Old Testament to realize this. And that is this, that what we do together sometimes is more powerful than what you do by yourself. That what we do together is more powerful at times than what we do by ourselves. And you say, are you sure about that? Yeah, let me give you a silly example, serious and silly. Protests. Sometimes the news announces these people are going on strike. These people are going to protest. Brace yourself. And you drive by City Hall, you drive by the local store that this protest is going to happen, and it's two people standing with a sign, and their level of enthusiasm tells you they don't want to be there. And they're saying, we protest. And they hold a sign, and every once an hour, they're kind of like those animatronic figures. They just raise the sign up once and put it down. And you have to wait for them to do it because that's the most exciting part of the day. Just two people. And when you drive by, you don't think that they've made a statement. You just feel sorry for them. Like, oh, man, I'm so sorry they made you do that. A protest that's so small, a protest that's so narrow, a protest that lacks inertia and enthusiasm really makes no big statement. But then you can have a rally that's hundreds, thousands of people, that fills all the National Mall in Washington, D.C. And that doesn't just make an impression, that makes history. People talk about it. People photograph it. It makes the history books. It leaves an impact. What we do sometimes together in mass can be far more effective than what we do individually. And that was absolutely true of the nation of Israel. God called them in Exodus 19 to be a kingdom of priests, to ministry and to display and to mediate the word of God and the truth of God through demonstrating it in his laws and communicating theology. And they did that throughout their entire history. They became a walking case study to themselves and to the world about who God is and what he was all about. Whether that be his deliverance in the Exodus, whether that be his holiness or preservation in the wilderness, whether that be his agenda to conquer the world in the conquest, whether that be absolutely his dominion in his kingdom, and whether that be that he was absolutely holy and he is so righteous that he will send his people out of the land in the exile. The reason the nations could see that, the reason that they could observe that, the reason that had an impact on the entire known world is because you just didn't have an individual Israelite illustrating it. You had a whole nation. You had a whole nation showing it. That's what carries an impact. Corporate witness, it matters. What we do together sometimes is more powerful than what you do by yourself. Do you need to do things by yourself? Absolutely. But don't discount how profound it is when we are together. And one of the ways, and like I said, this is quite providential for the season that we are in, that we demonstrate corporate witness in a pivotal and compelling way is by virtue of our holidays. By virtue of our holidays. The way we celebrate, what we celebrate, says a lot. And you say, are you sure about that? Yeah. Sometimes I love talking to international students and asking them what they and their peers across the world think of America, think of the United States. And they say, Americans are about three things. And I say, what is that? Rights, money, and eating. And I say, rights, money, and eating. How did you get that? They say, think about their holidays. What is the birthday of the United States? July 4th. What do we call it? We do not call it Romans 13 Day. We do not call it Submit to the Government Day. We do not call it Happy Birthday, America. We call it Independence Day. We're all about rights. And what do? We spend money to what? Eat. And then July moves forward. And then you get toward moments like Halloween and Christmas. And they're really kind of in the continuation of holidays. Why? Because the sales for those holidays happen in August, once you finish selling off everything you had for July 4th. And so now, what do people know? Oh, yeah. What do people do for Halloween? What do they do for Christmas? In an American perspective, you buy stuff with money. Often it revolves around food. So you eat, and you are so happy you have the right to do so. That's what happens. And then Thanksgiving's tucked in there, but Thanksgiving is really now the precursor to what? Black Friday. And what do we do on Black Friday? We have celebrated that we have the right to have eaten, and now we can spend what? Our money. That's what we do. And just so that the online people are not outdone, we have what? Cyber Monday. And then just in case you have a pang of conscience, it's coming up. There is Giving Tuesday. For all the nonprofit organizations that would like your donation, rights, money, and eating. And then you have January 1st, which is just the same thing. And then you have Valentine's Day. Guess what we do there? We have rights and money and eating. And then the list continues on and on. And then there's Good Friday, but really Americans don't focus on that, but we as Christians should. And then there's Sunday, which is Resurrection Sunday. They call it Easter. And what do they really do on Easter? They have Easter eggs and eating ham and things of this nature. And it just goes on and on and on until, oh yeah, we're back to July 4th again. Rights, money, eating. How did they get that? How do people understand that? Because of our holidays. Because that's what we do as Americans, as a nation, what? Together. It sends a signal across the world. And are you saying, well, should we just not celebrate any of those holidays? That's not what I'm saying. What I am saying is that holidays are powerful. Holidays are powerful. What we do in them matters. And what we do as a church in them is quite profound. And God knew that. This wasn't just created by America. This dynamic isn't just generated in the modern day. God knew that from the very beginning. And so he ordained Israel to have certain holidays to help them understand what you do together is sometimes more powerful than what you do by yourselves. So if you're going to make a statement together, make a good statement. Make a good statement. And so God ordains holidays. And what we will see through this is that there are rich theology in holidays. Rich theology and holidays that we can meditate on and we can learn about, but even more, what we need to remember, because this message is about ecclesiology, about what we do together as corporately, what we do in corporate witness, is this, that we need to be deliberate when we are together in celebrating these holidays to make sure the depth of theology tucked into every holiday that we biblically celebrate is declared corporately to the whole. And the passage that really instructs us on the power of this and the depth of this is Leviticus 23. Turn there in your Bibles with me. Leviticus 23. The book of Leviticus, as you know, is about the holiness of God. And we have seen and we observe in the book of Leviticus God's holiness in so many areas. The way you become holy and worship must be holy.
the way you handle what we might call gray areas of life, that must be holy. You have the Day of Atonement, which is absolutely holy. And in the way you conduct yourself personally, and even in your private life, must be holy. But not only is your private life have to be holy, your corporate life, what you do together as a group, what we do together in corporate witness must be holy. And that's exactly where Leviticus 23 takes us. There are 6 points to this message because there are really 6 major festivals outlined in Leviticus 23. It's a calendar of worship, a calendar of worship. You could put it this way. We don't just want to have happy holidays. We want to have holy holidays. We don't just want to have happy holidays. We want to have holy holidays. And so let's walk through these holidays, understanding their theology, understanding how God ordained Israel to demonstrate this corporately. And that will both instruct us on a lot of devotional thoughts that we need to have as we think about our lives. And these carry over, and we'll see that soon enough. But at the same time, it's a reminder of the power and the need for deliberateness when we come together. So here's the first holiday. It's the Sabbath. It's the Sabbath. And if you want to understand what the Sabbath demonstrates, it's this, that God controls your reality. God controls your reality. Leviticus chapter 23, verse 3. For 6 days, work may be done, but on the seventh day there is a Sabbath of complete rest, a holy convocation. You shall not do any work. It is a Sabbath to Yahweh in all your places of habitation. As we have said, this is about the Sabbath, and overall, the Sabbath demonstrates the absolute lordship of God over all creation. That's what it was originally designed to be and do, that 6 days God made, and then everything that was made was set apart as holy to Yahweh on the seventh. In fact, it's really interesting that the seventh day, even though the first 6 days say evening and morning and evening and morning, next day, the seventh day doesn't have that language, because the seventh day was supposed to be the permanent state of the world, that it was supposed to be absolutely holy to God. It was supposed to be at rest and at peace and in complete dedication and consecration to the Lord. And the Sabbath, as it's talked about in verse 3, demonstrates that God is Lord of all. And how does God show that he is Lord of all? Simple. That he's Lord of you. That he's Lord of you. How does God show that he is Lord of all? Over all creation, over all of existence and reality, that he controls your reality. And that reflects the greater whole. You see, the Sabbath isn't just regulating what you do on Saturday. The Sabbath regulates what you do every other day, too. What does verse 3 say? It doesn't just start with the seventh day. It says what? For 6 days, work may be done. God controls how much you work. God controls how much you rest. God controls how productive you can be. God controls how limited you are. God controls how you shape your life. God controls how you shape your time. God controls how you shape everything that you are and your entire existence, because whether it's waking or sleeping, resting or working, doing or not doing, every single day, everything is regulated under him. The reason God controls all and the way he demonstrates he controls all is because he controls you. And that's what the seventh day demonstrates. You could think of it this way, and this is something that we might not think about. Israel has a holiday every single week. Israel has a holiday every single week. You say, man, I wish we had a holiday every single week. Israel has a built-in holiday every single week, and it is a massive holiday. It is something that truly has corporate witness. I lived in Israel for a smidgen of time, and it doesn't take too long to live in Israel until you really figure out how dominating this thing called the Sabbath is. You better have your grocery shopping done before 2:30 p.m. on Friday. You better be where you need to be and not in a taxi by 3 o'clock p.m. You better make sure if you're trying to get from one place to another on public transit that you don't put it off too much. By, say, noon, you should be back on IBEX campus. You better make sure that any business deal, that you do that by 10 a.m. 10 a.m. on Friday. And if you're trying to fly in for a business deal, do it Thursday, not Friday. There are so many things that have to be happening. In fact, you could simply put it this way. If you are in a hotel and you need to get to a different floor, get in the elevator before Friday night. Otherwise, you're stuck there for a long time. There are a lot of reasons that you start to immediately learn the nation shuts down at 4 p.m. Friday. And that has massive ramifications. And if you say, well, that's just the modern phenomena, no, even in Nehemiah 13, people were trying to gather outside of Jerusalem because they knew that Israel wasn't really keeping the Sabbath at that time. And Nehemiah comes out and says, we're going to keep it for real. And they didn't believe him. So they're just all camped out there the next week. And he says, you're just going to be out here and freeze. Go home. And they all went home. What does that show you? What you do together. When you do something together, it has a greater impact than what you do by yourself. For Israel, even in the modern day, the reality of the Sabbath controls their economy, controls their business, controls travel, controls commerce, controls shopping, controls life. That's what it does. And not just for them, for anyone they come in contact with. That's the power of corporate witness. You want to see, and God, this is what God ordained, that God controls everything. He controls our reality. The way Israel demonstrated corporately was because he controlled theirs. And by extension, he controlled everyone they came in contact with. That's the power of the Sabbath. That's the power of corporate witness. Now, we are not Sabbatarians. We do not believe that we have to keep the Sabbath exactly the way Israel kept it. Paul says in the book of Colossians and in Romans that one person may regard one day as special, and that's wonderful, but another may regard every single day as holy, exactly the way God originally intended it to be, and that is good too. This is a matter of conscience. Nevertheless, we do have a weekly celebration, do we not? We do celebrate the Lord's Day. And sometimes in thinking about this, some people say, oh, you know, I have so much fun at church, it almost feels wrong because it's supposed to be so serious and so somber. But what we forget is that the Lord's Day is a holiday. It's a celebration. So if you say, I have fun at church and I love fellowshipping with the friends and I love it and I have so much joy here, that's good. That's the entire point. Yes, there must be seriousness. Yes, it must be solemn. Yes, it is about the honor and glory of God, and we're not frivolous in that way. That's absolutely true. But if you enjoy it, there's no wrong in that. There's every right in that, because this is a celebration. This is a holiday. And this is such a powerful holiday as we do it together that it also dictates your life, just like it did Israel. It is a powerful corporate witness that has bearing even on your individual witness. How often at work do people say, what are you doing this weekend? How often do people ask when you come back from the weekend, how was your weekend? And what can we always say without fail? Church. Church. And that's corporate witness. That's the power of it. What you have shown people is that your life is controlled by God, because God controls actually everything. He controls your reality because he controls all reality. It's what dictates your weekend, and therefore, because it dictates your weekend, it dictates your week as you prepare for it. Life revolves around this. And so the Sabbath is a demonstration that God controls reality and the power of corporate witness. Here's the next holiday. Second one is that God ordains holidays to remind us of his rescue. Not just he controls reality, but of his rescue. And that is found in the holiday of Passover. Passover. Passover was a deliberately corporate, national, high-impact holiday for Israel. And we can see this in verse 4. For one, it says this, "These are the appointed times of Yahweh, holy convocations which you shall proclaim at the times appointed for them." The notion of an appointed time. The notion of an appointed time is when Israel would gather in a central location that we know it to be Jerusalem three times a year. Three times a year that they would gather in Jerusalem. Now think about this. That you and your family would have to relocate three times a year and travel a great distance potentially three times a year. That is disruptive. That is massive. For us nowadays, it may not be as massive because we have cars and helicopters and airplanes and things that you probably wouldn't take anyways to travel across Israel, but the cars and motorized scooters and buses and all that kind of stuff, taxis, Ubers, whatever, they would be useful in this situation. But back then in Israel, you walked it. Three times a year, you have to stop everything you're doing. You have to stop all your life. You have to stop all your business. You have to stop family gatherings and cycles and the like to go at an appointed time to a central place. And when you gather a nation in a central place, that's disruptive. It's busy. It's packed. It's crowded. It's for this very reason, and people knew how powerful this moment was, and people knew how large and massive this moment was. It's for this very reason, in AD 70, the Romans waited till Passover to besiege Jerusalem because they knew the most people would be there. You see, there's a corporate witness, and the nations, they can follow it. They can follow it. They can see it. There's a high impact that's happening there. But it's not just that Passover has a high impact for Israel and a high impact on the nations because it's one of those appointed times, as it says in verse 4. It says this in verse 5, in the first month. America's first month, technically, in our national cycle is July 4th. It's July. For Israel, it's Passover. America has it as July 4th because that's our Independence Day. Israel has it as their first month because what they revolve around, what they're supposed to revolve around as a nation, is redemption. It's redemption. That's what they're all about. What does our life revolve around? How do we understand what drives, what is first and foremost, what is primary in our lives? God set it for Israel. This is what drives your entire nation. This is its value. And it's by virtue of it being the first month of the year, it's redemption, it's rescue. And that helps us to understand the nature of Passover. Passover was celebrated because it was deliverance from wrath. It was an escape. It was a rescue. That's why you ate, as the text reminds us, verse 6, unleavened bread, because Israel was eager to leave the land and they needed to be ready because God was about to intervene to help them to escape from one slavery, an evil and wicked slavery of Egypt, to a blessed slavery under Yahweh, from one wicked master to a good master. They needed to be ready to do that, and so that's what Passover celebrates, the greatest rescue, the greatest liberation for God's people. And it not only was it about the past in Passover, it was about the future. That's why in verses 7 and 8, it talks about, on the first day, you shall have a holy convocation. You shall not do any laborious work, but for 7 days you shall bring near an offering of fire to Yahweh. And on the seventh day is a holy convocation. That language of the seventh day having a holy convocation should remind us of the Sabbath. And why do God's people celebrate the Sabbath? In part, it is to show that God controls all of your reality. But Israel and the people of God celebrated this Sabbath over and over and over again in hopes of a Sabbath to come. In hopes of a Sabbath to come. Do you not remember what the author of Hebrews says? The word Sabbath means rest. It's a Sabbath rest. And he says, let us enter into the rest. There is a rest to come. There is a rest to come. There is a Sabbath rest to come. God wanted every day to truly be a Sabbath, holy to God, and in total rest. But there is sin. But God reminds his people, just like I delivered you at Passover, I will deliver you to a new rest. I will deliver you to a new rest, and you need to celebrate. Your actions need to demonstrate that hope. And so what you have at Passover is a national, disruptive, impactful holiday that ties the past to the future of God's plan for rescue. And for Israel, like we just said, this is a big deal. You could say it's a big deal because it's disruptive. You can say it's a big deal because of the date. It's the first month. Here's another D word, if you want, for why it's a big deal. Diet. Diet. Whenever I talk to Israelis after Passover, they always talk to me about how much their stomach hurts. Because eating matzah, for me, it's a joy. I could do it all year. I like it. For other people, it hurts. And not only that, it's not only disruptive on one's personal health and hygiene, it changes how industry works in Israel. Because if you have to remove leaven, and you have to remove it all the way, that affects every single business, every single producer, every single grocery store, every single industry. They all have to gear up to that, and that costs money. And so when you do business in Israel, you start to realize really quick that resource allocation is a lot trickier than it looks because they have all these other things they have to allocate to. And in fact, just to put it in perspective, even when I was serving at Ibex, we had to stockpile certain contraband to help our students weather the storm of Passover. We had to start doing that in October, getting people to ship things over, you know, like bacon and other things to encourage people. One holiday doesn't just mean a holiday, one day. It controls your whole economic, buying, regulatory cycle for an entire year, especially when you do it as a nation, when you do it all together. This is a powerful demonstration to the world of a theology, the theology of rescue. And if you say, did it work? Did it really do something? Yes, we could talk about 70 AD. Yes, we could talk about a lot of different impacts that it may have had. But let's just do a fundamental one. Jesus died on Passover. Jesus died on Passover. The Last Supper during Passover of one region, his death was Passover for a different region. But no matter how you want to look at it, all of it is associated with Passover. Why? Because what Jesus did for us is the greatest rescue. We were slaves of sin. We were bound to death. We were doomed to die. There was no hope for us. We were in complete bondage. We were doomed. And then Christ stepped in. Christ stepped in. Suddenly, brilliantly, and he rescued us. He rescued us. We should have died. And he rescued us from that slavery. And there was no accident that God scheduled that for Passover so that everyone would understand the theology that he just fulfilled. And speaking of which, this is connected with something that we actually celebrate in light of that. We celebrate it frequently, once a month at least, and that's the Lord's Supper. Why do we eat unleavened bread at the Lord's table? Why do we drink the grape juice and such? Because it ties back to Christ's death, which ties back to what? Passover. And all the theology there is tucked in to the Lord's Supper. And there is a big impact here. This is big. Why? Because we don't just celebrate communion privately. We don't just celebrate communion by ourselves. We celebrate it what? Together. Corporately. And that makes an impact. Think about it this way. People might say, okay, how was your weekend? Oh, I went to church. What do you do at church? Oh, we have this thing called the Lord's Supper. What is that? And then you can tell them something. If there was no corporate witness, you don't have a witness in that situation. There is something big happening. And in fact, it's so big, it not only disrupts the world, it even disrupts us. It disrupts a worship service in a good way because it's something out of the norm. And all of a sudden, our minds are incensed and triggered to think about what is going on. And with a big impact comes big theology. Have you ever wondered why we focus so much on the Lord's Supper? Israel has all these holidays. We have only one, really, with baptism as ordinances to the Lord. But one repeated one, and that's the Lord's Supper because it contains so much. You have his death, do you not? You have atonement, do you not? Do you have, this is the blood of the new covenant. You have not only what you are saved from, but what you are saved what? To. And on top of that, you have Paul and Luke reminding us, do this until he what? Comes. You're not only looking at the past, you're not only looking at the present, you are looking at the what? The future. And somebody asks you, because this event is so disruptive, so impactful, what is the Lord's Supper all about? This is weird. What are you doing eating an unleavened cracker with some grape juice? How does that have any meaning whatsoever? You can tell them not only the gospel, but the entire story of the Bible in one ceremony. There is big theology here. Are we intentional about it? God ordained for Israel to do this ceremony of Passover together, to have the maximum impact on themselves and the world, because what they did together was more powerful than what they did what? By themselves. Are we that deliberate when it comes to our own holidays, which are actually tied to their holidays, and celebrating and putting forth something so central, what God did to rescue us? He rescued us. He controls our reality. Here's the third one. He reassures us. He reassures us. God ordained holidays for Israel to show his reassurance. In Leviticus 23, verses 9 through 22, what you technically have here are two festivals. Two festivals. But they're combined into one. And you say, how do you know that? Well, notice verse 9, it says, then Yahweh spoke to Moses. Then verse 23, when it talks about the Feast of Trumpets, it says, again, Yahweh spoke to Moses. And then in verse 26, it says, and Yahweh spoke to Moses. And then in verse 33, it says, guess, and Yahweh spoke to Moses. Whenever God speaks to Moses in the chapter, it structures the chapter. But in verses 9 through 22, which is just a very large section of text, what you have is God spoke to Moses, but yet there are two festivals in here. Two festivals, two separate ones. One is what we call counting the Omer, and if you want to use Jewish terminology, or the Feast of First Fruits. And then you have Pentecost, or the Feast of Weeks. But God combines them into one. God combines them into one because they are about one theme. One theme, one purpose, and that is reassurance. That God provides the start, and you got to trust him that he'll provide the what? The finish. God provided the part, and you got to trust him that he'll provide the what? The whole. That's what these festivals are about, and this is how it works. God commands Moses and says, when you enter the land which I'm going to give you, reap its harvest, then you shall bring in the sheaf of the first fruits of your harvest to the priest. When Israel collects the harvest, when they first start harvesting, the very first harvest, God instructs that they bring in the very first grains and stalks of plants that they have collected. Not just the general category of first fruits. In fact, this Hebrew word is very particular here for first fruits. It means not just the general grouping of that which you harvested first. It means the very first things you touched. The very first ones. The absolute number one things that you collected and harvested, you give that to God. And here's why and how you do it. You wave the sheaf before Yahweh. You offer up a male lamb. You offer it for a burnt offering, verse 12. You offer a grain offering. And you burn it all to the Lord. And why do you do all of that? You do all of that for a simple reason. The best that I have belongs to the Lord. I'm so thankful that he gave it to me. I dedicate it all to him by burning it to him. And even more, this is crucial.
I trust him to provide the rest. You say, how do you know that? Think about this. You don't know if you're going to collect any more grain after this. You don't know that. You presume it, but there could be a locust plague the next day. There could be frost the next day. There could be robbers the next day. There could be any kinds of catastrophes the next day. You have no idea if you're going to get any more food than that. And unlike that time, they don't, or unlike this time, they don't have Ralph's. So it's not as if they can just say, well, we didn't collect as much grain, so son, just go to the store and buy us some bread. If you don't collect that much grain, that's your year. That's your year. You just burned your only food supply for the year, potentially. That's the risk. It's a huge risk. It's a life or death risk. But what's the testimony? We trust God. He gave us this harvest. He gave us those stocks of grain. I believe he will give us the rest. And if he doesn't want us to have it, we would never have it anyway. That is the test of reassurance. This is a holiday dedicated to trusting God that he gave us what is initial so he can give us the rest. And this is, like I said, there are two festivals in part of this. One is the Feast of First Fruits or Counting the Omer. And you say, why is it called Counting the Omer? Omer means sheaf or stock in Hebrew. And people count the Omer because from that day that you had the first festival, you count 50 days for the second one. You count 50 days, 7 weeks for the second one. And you say, why do you do that? Because that takes you to the initial harvesting period. The initial harvesting period. It takes you through that time. And it's for this very reason. While the first festival is called the Feast of First Fruits or Counting the Omer, the second one is called Pentecost because it's after 50 days. It's after 50 days. And on this day, after you have done an initial harvesting, way more than the first fruits, way more than just the absolute first stalks of grain, but still, just the initial harvesting, still in that category, you bring several offerings to the Lord. You bring a burnt offering of dedication. You bring a sin offering of forgiveness. You bring a peace offering for fellowship. And you say, why do you have to bring all those things? Because it's a reminder. Do you want to understand why you can bring offerings to God? Why you can have a harvest at all? Why you have provision at all? It's because of your relationship with God. It's because of God's relationship with you. So often in our lives, we say, give us this day our what? Daily bread. And we just know we need to say that. But we also have this feeling like, yeah, give us this day our daily bread. Thank you for helping me get to Ralph's and back. That's what we're thinking. But what God reminds us is this: you are far more dependent than you realize. Far more dependent than you realize. If God doesn't have a relationship with you in any way, if God doesn't show mercy to you, you won't eat. You won't eat. You can't be productive. You can't provide. You can't sustain. It isn't just, I thank God because I got something on my own and I just have to give him a little bit of credit. You have to realize, without the Lord, you have no breath to collect. Without the Lord, you have no ability, no context, no environment, no means, no sustenance to ever do that at all. You are more dependent on him than you might realize. And these offerings reminded Israel, if you don't have peace with God, he won't provide for you. If you won't have forgiveness, provision, it's always a mercy. You need to be dedicated to God because that relationship, it is crucial. It is critical for every breath and everything you do and have. God and your relationship with him is not some compartment over here or something on the side that just supplements and has to be given credit to for what you did by yourself. No, everything through and through is him. Everything through and through is him. All I have and all that is involved in all that I have in the harvest for Israel is of God. That's what Israel needed to remember. And that's why it's called the Feast of First Fruits, because they are giving that to God in recognition of all that he has done for
them. And it is a national holiday. It's a national holiday because it's a holy convocation. It's a national holiday that would have an impact on the world because verse 22 of Leviticus 23 says that as they continue to harvest, they shouldn't reap the corners of the field. That is at least a 25% loss. Why do you take a 25% loss? Simple. You leave them for the afflicted and the sojourner. You leave them for the afflicted and the sojourner. Why? Because you don't need the 25% if you trust God to give you everything you need. That's the point of this. And it's a bold statement to the world. It's a bold statement to the world. We trust God. He provided us in part. He will provide us in whole. That's the bold statement. And the only reason they can make that bold statement is they're not doing this by themselves. They're doing it all what? Together. Corporate witness. Now, this feast of Pentecost, this feast of first fruits, this corporate witness with this high impact statement to the world, there's a lot of theology here. A lot. It's very rich and absolutely compelling. Let me just give you two impacts. Two impacts that it has on the whole story of Scripture. Here's the first one, and they kind of interrelate for sure, but here's the first one. Of course, this tells you the nature of the church. This tells you the nature of the church. When did God begin the church? On the day of Pentecost. The church by nature is first fruit. The church by nature is first fruit. On the one hand, it's a reminder that we don't have everything. We're not the whole. We're not the totality of everything. We don't bring in the kingdom. We are not the full kingdom. We're just what? A first fruit. We're a part that evidences the whole. We're not the whole. We're just the part. But on the other hand, it reminds us of our important calling. Just like a first fruit is a sample of a whole, or a sample is a taste of the complete, the church is a taste of heaven. The church is supposed to be the closest taste of heaven anyone will have this side of heaven. The church is the witness that there is more to come. The church is the testimony that God has not finished yet, but he has started something. The church is the taste, the sampling of hope and life and joy and transformation. That is our role. That is our role. That God can make all things new and right. How? Because when you come to church, you just see a glimpse of it. It's not done yet. That's part of it. That's part and parcel why we're not the whole. We're just the what? First fruit. More to come. More to come. That is our role. But here's second, a specific aspect of that. A specific aspect of that. And just think about this with me. And it's quite profound. That actually helps you to understand the church's resurrection. The church's resurrection. Even the rapture. In 1 Corinthians 15, Paul says this, that God will raise the dead in a particular order. Christ, then the firstfruits at his coming, and then the rest. Now that makes sense, does it not? Because the church is a firstfruit. And if we're a firstfruit of the resurrection, that means there's a part that will lead to a whole. And the whole of the resurrection happens when Christ returns. Daniel chapter 12 says when Christ comes to earth, he will raise the living and the dead, the just and the unjust. That's what he will do. The church is a first fruit of that. Now, if a first fruit is the first part of a whole, the initial that precedes what is to come, and if what is to come, resurrectionally speaking, is at Christ's second coming, then that means the church's resurrection as a first fruit must come before the what? The second coming, which is an argument for the pre-tribulational what? Rapture. And it tells you the function of it. When we are raptured, what are we testifying together? Christ will finish the job. What is in part will be the whole. And for those who put their trust in God and God converts them in the tribulational period, that's a hope, but it's also a warning because he will raise both the just and the unjust. just to eternal life, unjust to eternal what? Condemnation. It's a warning. That is in part what is going on here. And if you really put your thinking cap on, do you not remember there are two feasts combined in verses 9 through 22? One is counting the Omer, the very, very first of the first fruits. And then you have Pentecost. And then after that, implied you would have the whole harvest. Is that not exactly how the resurrection works? Christ is the very, very first harvest, is he not? The very, very first stalk of the harvest. Then you have what? The church at Pentecost. And then you have what? The whole that is to come. The way that God laid out these feasts, it was to give Israel a calendar of time to tell him what he was going to do throughout all of history, all of time. That's what he's doing here. It's quite profound. And all of this theology is embedded into these festivals, taught there, inculcated there for us to learn so that we can follow Paul's logic and other people's logic in the scriptures and learn these things. And Israel taught these things by virtue of their corporate witness. Here's the fourth one, remembrance. Remembrance. After you have the Feast of First Fruits and the Feast of Weeks, you have the Feast of Trumpets, verse 23 and 24. Again, Yahweh spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel, saying, in the seventh month, in the first of the month, you shall have a rest, a memorial by blowing trumpets." The seventh month in Israel is a very important month. For one, it's the seventh month. A seven is a number of fullness. And indeed, what is happening on this month is very full. It's a fulfillment. You have the Day of Atonement happening on this month. You have the Feast of Booths happening on this month. It's a very full month. And so to open it all up, to draw attention to it, and to get people to prepare, you have the Feast of what? Trumpets. You blow the trumpets to get everybody's attention. And what is it for? Notice what it says. You shall have a rest. And specifically, verse 24, a memorial. Now think about this with me. What is a memorial? When you look at a memorial in the nation's capital or in a museum, a memorial is what commemorates something. It's what monuments something. It's what memorializes something. It's what causes you to remember something. In fact, just think about the word memorial in there. Do you not hear the word memory? That's the entire point of a memorial. It's to remember. As believers, sometimes we're not very good at remembering. Even though the scripture in Deuteronomy reminds Israel to remember so that they don't grow complacent. Even though Psalm 103 reminds us to forget none of his benefits. We're very prone to forget. We're very prone to not remember. And as Israel is supposed to be preparing themselves for the Day of Atonement, as Israel is supposed to be preparing themselves to remember God's faithfulness in the Feast of Booths, they needed just time to remember. This is instructive. For what we do both as group and as individuals, we need to reminisce. We need to go down memory lane and recall all that God has done for us. We need to do it often. We need to do it individually. We need to do it corporately. And we're not talking just generically. That's not what's going on in the Feast of Trumpets. It's just a memorial period. You take some time and you recall, you recollect what God has done. Why? Simple. Because you forget none of his benefits. And when you remember, then you become thankful. When you remember, then you actually approach things the right way. And when you remember, you trust in him. You trust in him. God ordained holidays for remembrance. And by the way, that we do this corporately, we'll see how that works in a second. Point five, redemption. God ordained holidays, not only for rescue, but even for redemption. That's the Day of Atonement, verses 26 through 33. The 10th day of the 7th month, there will be a Day of Atonement. Now, there's technically a lot of instructions about the Day of Atonement, not even mentioned here. In Leviticus 16, you have an entire chapter earlier about the priestly regulations of how all the sacrifices are going to work on this particular day. But that's not God's concern in this chapter. God's concern in this chapter is how we celebrate Day of Atonement, what? Together. And there are two emphases here. One is this. Look at verse 27. It says this, you shall humble your souls. You shall humble your souls. In fact, it is so serious. Verse 29 says, if there is any person who will not humble himself on this day, he shall be cut off from his people. That's how serious it is. Humble yourself. And you say, why do we need to humble ourselves in light of the Day of Atonement? Why did Israel need to do that? Because when you humble yourself, and the way this often worked was for Israel back in the day, they fasted the whole day. No eating, no drinking, nothing. They fasted for 24 hours straight to afflict themselves. But affliction isn't good enough, because humbling is not on the outside. Humbling is on the inside. But we could do both. And Israel did both traditionally, just to put themselves in the right frame of mind. But when you make yourself weak like that, when you make yourself humble like that, then you start to realize what really matters. You start to realize what really matters. We have built so much to convince us of what really doesn't matter and to avoid what really does. That's what we've done. We're very talented at distraction. We're very talented at subterfuge. And we have created all that. But there is a reason in a hospital room no one cares about sports scores. There is a reason in a hospital room no one really cares about the stock market. There is a reason in the hospital room people are not worried about climbing the corporate ladder. There is a reason in a hospital room that all of those other concerns that seem to be so dominating, they just disappear. Because for the first time in a long time, people have clarity on what really matters, on what really is true. It's life, and it's what? Death. That's what you have. That's what you have to deal with. Everything else is just subterfuge. It's life and death. And when you humble yourself, finally you have clarity on what really needs to be taken care of. Then atonement matters. Then atonement matters. When you just want to accumulate stuff, when you just want the American dream, when you want to climb the corporate ladder, when you just want to be successful, atonement seems very, very irrelevant, except it's the most relevant thing there is. But you have to humble yourself to see it. That's why God demanded this of Israel. And there's another reason why he demanded them to humble themselves. It's this. When you're so weak because you're starving, because you haven't eaten or drunk the whole day and your throat is parched and all you can think about is eating or drinking, at that moment you realize how weak you are. How could you ever think you could save yourself? You can't even get a piece of bread. How do you think you can muscle up to do anything? You are very, very weak. And so God says, humble yourself so that you know what's really valuable, what you really need. And you don't live by bread alone. You live by every word from the mouth of God. And you live because he atoned for us in his son, who paid the price for us. And you can't do it on your own. There's no way you can do it at all. You can't even survive a day very much and very functionally without eating or drinking. What makes you think you're so mighty? You're nothing. And that's one part of the Day of Atonement. But notice this, verse 32. Here's the other side of the Day of Atonement. It's a Sabbath of complete rest to you. You shall humble your souls evening from evening until evening. You shall keep your Sabbath. Why does God emphasize that there's complete rest? Because atonement, yes, you need it. You have to have it. And you can't do it on your own. But you're not just atoned from something. You're atoned to something. And what are we atoned to? Total rest. Total
rest. Atonement buys us rest. Atonement buys us everything new. Atonement buys us hope. This is a powerful, powerful message. And Israel was going to deliver it quite powerfully through corporate witness. Here's just a simple example of that. When the Day of Atonement happens, even in modern Israel, everything goes to a complete standstill. And when we mean complete standstill, we mean complete standstill. There was a tradition at Ibex that on the Day of Atonement, the night thereof, we would walk on the highway like it was a sidewalk. People play frisbee, and the only people who would kind of distract us are cyclists from Jerusalem to Tel Aviv, you see, because Jerusalem to Tel Aviv is all downhill, so you don't even have to be that athletic to do that. You just have to have enough money to buy the taxi to come back. So people would just coast down, you know, secular Jews, and they would just run down the freeway, zipping at crazy speed. But we could just walk the highway. No problems. Never be afraid to get hit by a car. Never. Try that on the 5. Don't try that on the 5. That makes an impact. That makes an impact. What we do together is more powerful than what we do apart. In Israel, one way or another, even if they didn't believe this message, they were communicating the power and the necessity of atonement. Do our holidays have the right theological depth? And do they have the right deliberateness that we celebrate together, that we can communicate things that way? Well, here's a 6th one. Realization. Realization. That God established holidays, holy holidays, to show that things, his promises will be realized in the end. And this is the Feast of Booths, verses 34 through 44. 7 days, a holy convocation to God. Why are they celebrating this? Well, in part, they are celebrating this, and you can see this in verses 37 and 38. It is because the harvest is finally done. What God started, he what? Finished. And you give thanks to him and trust him at the beginning, and you give thanks to him at the what? At the end. That's what we do. That's what we do. We don't forget to have gratitude at any part of the process. We are always supposed to be thankful. That's what God taught Israel, and the principle still remains true to this day. But it's not just about Israel's harvest time. It's about their history. You see, in verses 39 through 44, God gives an exact way that they're supposed to celebrate this Feast of Booths, this completion of the harvest season. And this is so important. On the first day, you shall take for yourself foliage of beautiful trees. Note this, it's very important. Palm branches and boughs of leafy trees and willows of the brook. And you shall be glad before Yahweh your God for 7 days. You're going to construct this into booths, and you're going to live in those booths. Why? Because God's faithfulness in bringing in the harvest should remind Israel of his historical faithfulness to bring them in from the land of the wilderness. When they were in the wilderness, they lived in booths. When they were in the wilderness, they lived in temporary shelters. They lived away from home. They had no home. But what they celebrated in the Feast of Booths is that God preserved them and he would get them home. He would get them home. That's what they celebrated in the Feast of Booths. And they celebrated the Feast of Booths not only with the harvest in mind, not only with history in mind, but with hope in mind. They celebrated over and over and over again in order that they knew that God one day, he wouldn't just be faithful to them in the harvest. He wasn't just faithful to them in history. He would do that with them for the rest of their life, for eternity. That's what they understood. That's why they celebrated this festival. And it was corporate. It was corporate. And even today in Israel, people live in booths for 7 days. It's a spectacular celebration. It's fun. And students love it at Ibex. That's why most go, well, people want to go in the fall, because it is a fun, fun time. But it communicates a message of God's faithfulness. And you say, was this message effective? How was this theology carried out? Well, just think about this with me. When Israel returned from exile from Babylon, guess what the number one festival they celebrated was? The Feast of
booths. Why? Because they said, God got us through. God got us through, and he's going to get us home. And we might not be home yet, but he will get us home just like he got our ancestors home from the wilderness. They celebrated the Feast of Booths. In Zechariah chapter 14, when Zechariah prophesies about what Israel's going to do in the future, in the kingdom, guess what he says? Everyone, the whole world, will celebrate the Feast of Booths. Do you want to know why? Because when Jesus returns, what are we going to say to Christ? Thank you. You got us what? Home. You not only started the job, but you what? You finished it. That's the theology that's carried out there. Matthew 17 at the Transfiguration. Peter, what did he want to build for Jesus? Booths. You say, man, why did Peter want to do that? Is it because he puts his foot in his mouth? Yes, he does. But at the same time, he actually had a kind of cogent idea, which was what? He hoped that this would be the fulfillment of Zechariah's prophecy right then and there. And God had to remind him, listen to my son. You know, in chapter 16, previous, he just said he has to what? Die. This is not that time yet. This is not that time yet. But they were hopeful for that. And speaking of hopeful, now you understand the triumphal entry. What were they doing at the triumphal entry? They not only put their coats on the ground, but they put what kind of branches? Palm branches. And what kind of branches are used to build booths? Palm branches. What Israel was hoping for was that this would be the time when the King of Kings would arise and he would bring them what? Home. He would finish the job and the kingdom would be established and everything would be made right and changed. And yes, this was a step in that direction, but they thought they wanted it in full and they didn't understand that there was a necessary step of the cross. That's it. But nevertheless, the message rang true and it is part and parcel of everything that will happen, which is this: God will finish the job. God will finish the job. There will be a day. There will be a day when we all have a true triumphal entry. And we cut those palm branches down and we have a Feast of Booths because, as Zechariah prophesied, we will celebrate the Feast of Booths and we will salute the King of Kings because he got us what? Home. The one who started will be the one who finished. And you could think of it this way, if you want confidence of all of that. Did God fulfill the theology of Passover? Yes, he did in Christ. Did he fulfill the theology of Pentecost? He did in the what? The church. So since he's marching through the whole calendar, fulfilling all its theology, don't you think, since there's only one festival left, that he won't fulfill that one? He's already fulfilled everything else. You're just looking at one more. He will finish the job. By way of conclusion, there are lots of lessons to be learned here. Thinking about reality, thinking about our rescue, thinking about reassurance and remembrance and redemption and realization. But we can think about those as individuals, but we never want to forget this. Israel demonstrated not those things by themselves, but as a what? As a group, as a whole, corporately. There is corporate witness. And here is the reminder, when we come together, when we do these things together, our witness as a whole is more powerful than even as an individual. It makes a statement to this world. And it doesn't matter if you're in the pulpit or if you're in the pew. You being here, your presence here, us being in mass is powerful. It is designed to do something. When we are together, we make a statement. So it better be a good one. Better be a good one. And that's where holidays comes in. We need to look at our holidays and we need to make sure that they tell the theology that God imbued them, whether that be Christmas or Good Friday or Resurrection Sunday or every Sunday, particularly Communion Sunday. Because think about Communion Sunday. Is Passover connected to that? Yes, it is. Is Pentecost connected to that? We do it in church. Absolutely. How about the Feast of Trumpets, Remembrance? Is that connected to that? What does Jesus say? Do this in remembrance of me. It's absolutely connected. Is atonement connected to that? Absolutely. What about Feast of Booths? We do this until Christ what? Returns and fulfills that feast. Everything is connected into that. It's a profound and powerful moment as long as we're deliberate about it and we do it together. Because when we do it together, here's what we testify to the world. This work, this all-sufficient work of Christ isn't just good for one person. It's good for what? All from one end to the other end, from all people, nation, tribes, and tongues. We do this together in solemn solidarity and demonstration that Christ is all in all. And you can't do that by yourself. What we do together is more powerful. Never think, oh, I just showed up at church, nothing really much happened, it wasn't that big of a deal. It's a big deal. It's a big deal. Because what we do together is more powerful than what we do apart. We just need to be deliberate about that and bring what is implicit and make it explicit. And that way, let us this season not just have happy holidays, let's have holy holidays. Shall we pray? Our God and Father, thank you for your word and for the profound reminders and for the profound design that you have for corporate witness and holidays. And as we go through this season, make us deliberate to bring out the riches of theology, the riches of the truth that give hope and rescue and redemption and reassurance and realization of your promises and the like. All of these things that refresh our soul, may that be brought forth. And may every Sunday and every time we gather, may we remember how it matters and how powerful it is. And we don't think that we have no role because we're just not up in front. No, no, no. We remember you use it all for your glory because you designed that what we do together is more powerful than what we do by ourselves. So may it be, O God, that we redeem this season. In your name we pray. Amen. Amen.